Session number 33503, reel 4.
We were out most of the night in the countryside. We ran and we were exhausted. And as dawn broke, round about 6, we started to trickle back to the camp. Of course, as we got to the camp, the guards were all there. We started to walk inside and we could see that something big had happened. And those that were a bit sluggish in walking through the gate got a rifle butt over their back. The guards were in a terrible, terrible mood. You just had to look at one of them and it meant a rifle butt round your ear. Several blokes had their heads cracked open, back split. We all rushed in the gates and back to our huts. Almost immediately, they blew the whistle for parade. And we were taken to work as usual. No breakfast, nothing. Taken to work. And the guards were grim. So we went to work that day. The chap I worked with wouldn't speak all day. Actually, I got on quite friendly with him. Well, you do if you're working with somebody, you know, you must get some sort of understanding between each other. And the war wasn't mentioned at all in the usual way. He was a German civilian. He was a man about 50. He was obviously exempt from the war work. He must have been sick or something like that. I didn't inquire and he didn't tell me. That day I got nothing out of him. We went back to camp, we immediately put in our huts and the food was very late coming. The Germans intent on punishing us somehow. The following morning we went to work and this German showed me the paper, the local paper. It was only about the size of an English newspaper, big style, you know. There was only a single sheet, and the whole page was ringed with black. And the words across the top, "The death of Dresden." And the rest of the paper went on to tell what had happened. Apparently the town had almost been razed to the ground. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of people killed. And this German was telling me the horrible scenes. They had to pile the dead up against the shop front so they could take them away in carts. Back to the story now. We went on work as usual. Days passed. And like I said before, the war was coming to an end. In fact, all the signs were there. In some cases, you could walk along a main road and all of a sudden an American or a British plane had come over the hedges with machine guns rattling the road, fighter planes, so they couldn't have been very far away. But we carried on as usual, and I think it must have only been about two or three weeks after Dresden raid. Not quite good on the times, but it must have been very shortly after, because as my memory serves me, I wasn't very long in Brooks. And it started like the air raid in the middle of the night. We were asleep and the lights went on suddenly. It must have been about 2 o'clock in the morning, and all the lights were controlled by the Germans. There were no switches in the huts. They turned the lights off at 10 and put them on when it was dark, you know. 10 o'clock was bedtime and they turned the lights out. Anyway, the lights went on. Hell of a lot of commotion outside and people shouting. And like before, we wondered what was happening. The doors were open and the Germans came in, German sergeants and that. And they told us that the war was over. They said the war had finished, and they didn't have too many details, but the fact is that there was no more fighting. And we were told that we would have to stay in the camp. There would be no more work. We would stay in the camp until our allies reached us. They didn't know when that would be, but their orders were just to stop and wait developments. And they went out. The lights were left on. And you can imagine that pandemonium went. Everybody talking, shouting, laughing. Out into the compound we went, which in a normal way could never have been tolerated by the Germans. You would have been shot. But nobody bothered. The lights were on all around the barbed wire. The guards were still there, but they realised that their war, the same as ours, was over. And the night drew on. And the morning came back, 6 o'clock in the morning, and of course the Germans tell me we weren't going to work, so time hung heavy on our hands. And then a thought started to take place in my mind. The more I thought about it, the more I was keen to do it. The fact was that when I was working with this German in the factory, the tools were supplied, obviously, by the factory, and amongst the tools was this was an electric meter, a testing meter for testing electric circuits, and this was my trade, and I did it in Civvy Street. And these meters are very expensive, and I remember this one was a beautiful thing. It was, to my mind, it was like owning a car, a Rolls Royce. It had everything on it. And we used to treat it with care. It was nearly new. We used to treat it with care and carefully wrap it up at night and put it back in the cupboard. And I thought, past my mind, the war's over. If I can get my hands on that meter and take it back to England, that would be a climax. It'd be a marvellous thing for me. And I said this to Jan. And he said, well, you take a chance. But I couldn't forget this. I couldn't forget this meter. I thought we saw it would be languishing away in this cupboard. Somebody had probably come along a later date and clear the cupboard out and smash it on a rubbish tip. And the thought of it was breaking my heart. So, around about 8 o'clock in the morning, Jan, who was always game for anything, Jan and I walked over to the barbed wire. And there were a few holes through the barbed wire where we'd gone for the air raid and never been bothered to be patched up. And there was this guard outside patrolling, man about 60, 65, fed up with the war, like we were. He'd just heard the news, and I suppose he didn't know what was going to happen to him, so he, as far as he was concerned, anything would go. So we said to him, I've left some clothes in the factory. Can I go and get them? I said, it's a battle dress jacket, which I left there. And as I haven't got one, I'd like to get it before we have to leave the camp. We didn't know how long we were going to be there. We thought perhaps that the Allies were marching any minute, you know. That's how we thought at the time. The German guard said, it's up to you. Couldn't care less. You take your chance. That's it. So through the barbed wire we went. And we went to the factory. It was about 10 minutes walk. The streets were very quiet. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, but a lot of people must have heard over the wireless what happened. I don't think there was much work going on that day. And we got to the factory gates. It was a huge compound of several buildings and surrounded by a wall with big gates going in. And normally you just march in with your guards and then go to your place of work and go there. I knew exactly where I was going, and we both walked through the main gate. As we walked through, there was rifle fire, and we looked to the right of us and we saw the German guards. Well, actually, the German SS. They were their super troops. There was a company of them stationed in the town, and they were obviously put there to guard the factory against looters. And they came up to us, and I told them that they held us under, you know, they had machine guns trained on us. We told them where we were from the camp, and I'd come to get this coat, this battle dress. And they said, "You're just unlucky. You go without your battle dress. Take no chances. Go back to your camp. Anything can happen." So, back to the road we went. Jan said to me, "Couldn't I do with something to eat?" So we decided to have a walk through the village. And we did. And we saw these chickens running around this backyard. And Jan said, "Well, they won't miss one of them, will they?" And with that, we picked up a few bricks and slung them. We caught one chicken and killed it. We picked it up, and off we walked into the small village. We've just picked a door at random, we knocked at it. A woman came to the door, and she looked at us in surprise, and we told her we're prisoners of war, but she could see that. We had khaki uniform on. They'd seen us working, so they knew who we were. And Jan said to her, "Did you know the war was over?" And she said, "Yes." Jan said, "We're not enemies anymore. Will you cook this chicken for us? We're very hungry and we'd like it to eat. Even if you only boil it." She said, "Come inside." We went in, there were about three children there on the floor. And we just sat there talking to her, and she started to pluck this bird. She was quite an elderly woman. They probably weren't her own children, but she could have been looking after them. She might have been their grandmother. And I remember the scene so well. We were sitting on two wooden chairs in the sort of a kitchen. And she was sitting on the chair, saying how terrible war was. It'd be lovely to get back to peaceful ways again. And we were agreeing with her all the time. We were saying we want to get back to our wives. And it seemed as if all hell had let loose. Gunfire, machine gun fire. We'd hear a couple of planes overhead. We rushed through the door to the village street. And there, all the villagers were running around, milling around here and there, frantically, not knowing which direction to run, trying to pull children with them. And we hear the artillery shells flying over. A couple of them hit the village, and we could see one house down and another one on fire. And we'd also hear machine guns. And one man told us that the Russians were coming in to take over the town. But the SS were fighting a rearguard action. Anyway, decided that we forget about the chicken for now. There was more important things, and self-preservation was our main target. We decided to go back to the camp, which we did. When we got there, it was in a worse state than the village. The hut I used to live in was demolished. Several men were dead. A plane had bombed it. And like the village street, the other prisoners were walking around in knots and trying to decide what to do. We had a sergeant major, British sergeant major there, Sergeant Major Cohen, I remember him, tall bloke. And he was our sort of senior soldier on the camp. He was the one that had dealings with the Germans and sort of passed on their orders to us. He had a little office of his own, and he was more or less in charge of us. He said to us, well, things were a bit dicey. As far as I can make out, the Germans have told us that the war is over, but the SS are fighting on. And the Russians, who intended to come in peacefully, have decided to blast their way in. And they were only about 3 or 4 miles away, and they were just bombing them until the SS surrendered. He said, you can take your pick. There's two things you can do. You can either go down the coal mine, which will be safe, and then come up when it's all over. Or you can make your way to a town called Carlsbad, which was about 100 miles away. And he knew for a fact that the Americans were there and they weren't coming any further. But the Russians were due to take over this part. Well, Jan and I had a chat. We didn't know what to do. Artillery was still firing, and there was a plane above, and everybody was going mad. Some of the chaps were heading for the mine. They obviously thought it was a good idea to go down there because it would be quite safe there. And then perhaps the next day come up, and the Russians would be in charge and it would all be peace again. Jan and I didn't take that view. We thought, well, I don't know, we don't fancy being caught by the Russians. We could be months getting home if they took over, because we heard so many stories about them, and we didn't take too lightly to them. So Jan said, let's make a go for Carlsbad. And there was another bloke there, Bill Parks, his name was. He was in our hut, and he was one of the survivors. He was outside that too when he got hit. And he said to us, you're going to make a go for Carlsbad? We said, yeah. So he said, right, we'll make a go together, three of us. We got a few things that we could get together, and off we went onto the main road. Well, by this time, this would be about 11 o'clock in the morning. By this time, the main road was chock-a-block with people. German soldiers as well, trying to get off as far away from this place called Brooks as possible. It appears they also didn't have much faith in the Russians. The Russians apparently didn't like to take too many prisoners. And there were civilians, little carts, a few horses, horse-drawn carts, mostly with their belongings on the top. And it was just like an exodus. It was probably something like the crowd at Wembley on a cup final day, making their way down a main road. And we joined them. There was several British blokes in little knots, making their way, little clicks. Us three stuck together, and we started to trudge towards this place called Carlsbad. We knew this road would take us more or less in that direction, and we'd been going for about an hour walking along. It was early spring or early summer. We came across this little truck. It was run these three-wheel trucks, one wheel in the front, two wheels at the back, and it was powered by a motorcycle engine. And the back was just like a little builder's truck, flat, no top on it, just a flat truck, small thing. And there's a man and his wife, well, the owners of this truck, little van, little thing it was, something like an 800 weight. And they were fairly well dressed, and they were Germans, man and his wife. They were about in their 40s, something like that. And their clothes were quite expensive. And the truck was stationary. On the back of the truck, we could see most of their valuables. Several things. There was a woman's fur coat there, pushed down. There was pots and pans, radios. All sorts of things I'd already put in. They were obviously making their way away too. They didn't fancy staying behind. They soon as had their chance with the Americans. But the man was leaning over the engine part of this contraption. And obviously it had broken down. So we sauntered over. And he had said something to the man, and the man was quite surprised to know that a prisoner could talk fluent German, and he spoke to him. He answered to me, things packed up suddenly and I can't get it going. Well, it was something up my street. I've been working on motor cars for years and years, and I knew something about them. And the end told him, so I started to look. I forget offhand what it was, but it's something not very difficult anyway. Wire off, something like that. Probably something simple, but the fact of the matter is I've got it going. And the engine started up. And with that, the man said to Jan, thank you very much. And went to hand us over a packet of cigarettes. I said to Jan, there's room for us on the back. And Jan said, told this to the German. The German looked at us and he wasn't too keen. And Jan said to him, look, you can only drive at walking pace, and obviously you're going to get people putting their hands in and taking stuff out as you go along. You won't be able to stop them. But at least with us on the back, at least your stuff you've got there is be safe, and we'll look after it for you. All we want is a lift towards Carlsbad, even if it's only half the way. And the Germans said they were going there as well. They said they'd heard about the Americans being there. And I said, you're probably better off if you've got us with you. And it's a point the German had to agree with. So eventually we three of us got on the back, just room for us, sitting on the back with our feet dangling over the back. And we set off. And from time to time somebody would try to climb on, but we just got a bit tough and kicked them off. That's how life was in those days. Survival, self-survival was the main thing. We didn't go very fast. We couldn't do because of the people. But at least we weren't walking. And time went on. It was the first day, I know. We were several days on this road, but this was the first day. And several things happened on this day. And I think it must have been some of the late afternoon. The people were still on the road. The people were stretching for mile upon mile in front of us. And as we were getting along, more people were joining the march or the trek. They all wanted to get to Carlsbad, which was quite a big town. They thought it'd be safer there. This part we were in at the moment was no man's land. Anything could happen. If the Russians came in, everybody could get killed. Tanks and anything, so they just wanted to move. We came to a river, and apparently the bridge across the river had been bombed. There was no bridge there. And the road ran parallel with the river, and there was a sort of a grass slope and about 200 yards of field before you came to the river. And there was another bridge about 2 miles up farther, and I suppose most of the people were making with this other bridge. We just followed them along, and by this time the convoy got very big. There was lorries on the road, there was horses and carts, there was people walking, people on bicycles, people on little vans like we had. And it's a very slow moving process. And then suddenly this spotter plane came over and started to shell the road. They started to shell the road. The spotter plane was to direct the aircraft, the artillery. And sure enough, shells were dropping on the road, and pandemonium set loose again. Everybody ran, left their vehicles and rushed. Some were rushing down to the river. Yan and I and Bill decided to rough it. The two Germans, the German man and woman, there was a ferry going across the river. Kind of a little ferry boat, and it was operated by one man, one old boy. And I suppose in peacetime we had a fairly easy little number, taking one or two people across that didn't want to go over the bridge. The bridge was about half a mile down the road. And the river wasn't very wide, it was only about 100 yards across. And I suppose people try to get down there to get on this boat. This ferry was this side, and the old boy was standing there, and people were clambering on this kind of an oversized punt, I suppose. It seemed like a flat bottom thing. Anyway, the German and his wife started to run, and as they ran down the slope, we were crouching down behind a lorry, and we could see them going, and the artillery shells were dropping. And one of the shells, or a few of the shells even, dropped right near them. And we saw the man flung up in the air, and flung about 4 or 5 yards away, and he just fell down motionless. And the woman just looked on and screamed and ran on to the boat. By this time, things were hotting up a bit, so we got underneath the lorry. This huge 5-ton lorry with stuff on top. We decided that if we got underneath it, we'd be pretty safe. This is what we did. After a time, the shelling eased up. And we looked around, there was a scene of devastation. One or two bodies were lying around, a couple of horses, and things looked pretty rough all round, you know. Yeah, and Bill and I said, well look, at least we're the owners of a truck now with all this stuff. We went back to the truck, we looked to the river, and there was no sign of people there. The women, they'd obviously gone. The woman had probably got to the other side and just ran. Anyway, we weren't too concerned about things like that. We trying to think how we could get out of it alive. And we had this truck full of all the equipment. And we waited around for probably a couple of hours, and a spotter plane came over again, and some more anti-aircraft shells came over. People still scattering around, but eventually things eased off.